Sports, wine, life. This is the Macko and Cos podcast.
Hey everyone, and this is the Macko and Cos podcast. I'm Matt Cos. That's Bob Mackowitz. The only reason we didn't record sooner was because I was in Mexico, which is why we haven't been on since Game 7 of the World Series. And Bob, I don't know how to discuss what happened because I don't have notes. I watched the game in a sports bar in Mexico, surrounded mostly by Dodger fans. It was fucking horrible. I don't know how to properly talk about it.
Is that an invitation for me to start?
Yes. And hi, Bob, by the way. Hey.
Yeah, hey, nice to see you. Hope you enjoyed Mexico.
It was great.
Did you enjoy the food?
The food was really good. Oh, good. Let's start here. The solace of it. I got to tell you, I miss all the little taco stands. There's hundreds of them, and they're all so good. And then there's other just random places with people making sandwiches on street corners, and it was all so yummy. And by the way, even the guacamole was hot. Like, I was going to put some guac on, and the guy...
Like spicy hot, you mean?
Spicy hot, and the guy was just, like, hot. And I'm like, so I just dipped my finger, and I did the stereotype. Like, just intake of breath. So, yes, great time.
I'm sure everybody tuned in today to hear hot taco talk. So, here we go. Soft shell or crunchy shell?
Soft shell, and it's got to be corn. The corn tortilla over the flour tortilla. It's not even close.
And where are you on the fish taco?
Oh, I love the fish taco. There's no fish tacos on the street, and I'm fine with that.
Right.
I am fine with that, but if for me, fish taco is number one.
Have you ever done the old El Paso tacos at home?
Of course. Who hasn't done old El Paso at home?
It is the best hack, because it's pretty easy. You just got to fry up some ground beef, and you add the packet.
Yeah.
And what do? You shred cheese, you chop up some lettuce. Mm-hmm. And you get a little sour cream.
Yeah, maybe some tomatoes, depending.
Maybe some tomatoes, right, of course. Pretty easy, but it's so fun. Underrated.
Yeah. It really...
Underrated. It's a good thing you had access to tacos, because it wasn't the easiest weekend.
No. No, like I'm... Honestly, I tweeted this out. I know how lucky I am because of my job. I can fly home from vacation, and I'm excited to work. I never take that for granted. Most people are like, oh, I got to go back to work. I wish I was still in the Bahamas or wherever. I get excited. This time, I am so glad I was not on air on Monday and today. I feel like a coward. It was planned. I had these days off. But I don't know how to do this.
Okay, so I will get started then. You know what it reminded me of? Nothing in sports, because really, in my lifetime, I've never really seen anything like that in sports, whether it was that Game 7 or that particular playoff run. I don't think I'll ever see anything like that again. It reminded me of the movie Rocky, in that the investment in Rocky, and the Jays are playing Rocky here, really in the end didn't come down to the winning. You would love to see Rocky win, but in Rocky 1, he loses. And the win is that he's in love with Adrian, and he's reclaimed meaning in his life. I can be philosophical about this. I think I can be philosophical about it because I've seen a couple championships in this city in my lifetime. I think if I was, 30, it might be harder.
Mm-hmm.
But, the Raptors have made a huge difference in how we view these things, because it's not really a drought for the city. It's been since 2019, since we had a victory parade. But the way they played, I sent out a tweet before Game 7, or a Blue Sky. I'm not on Twitter. I'm on Blue Sky. I sent out a Blue Sky.
Sure.
Which is, if you're not cheering for the Jays tonight, you don't love baseball, you love winning. For everybody who loved baseball, how could you like a team more than the way the Jays played? Just every single time they pushed an at-bat to 8 pitches. Even in their losses, there were little wins. They just never gave up. It was totally and utterly relentless. And we believe in life that should be paid off. Because we've been told ever since we were little, if you work hard, the world is your oyster. And then you get a little older and you realize that's fucking bullshit. The world is not your oyster.
But still work hard. Still work hard.
But what working hard is a guarantee of character. It guarantees no success, but it is a guarantee of character. And so even in losing, I think what we were reminded of is doing it the right way has to be its own reward. nothing else is guaranteed. And so when I think about Ernie Clement saying, I cried for the last hour and I love these guys, everybody loves each other when you win. Winning fixes everything. It is not hard to love your team or for teammates to love each other when they won. But if you can lose in the most heartbreaking fashion, turn around and say, I just wanted to do it for these guys. That means so much more than if you're holding the trophy and you're covered in champagne saying, I'm so glad I did it with these guys. Not that the winning part is invalid, but it just means so much more if you can lose and hold your head up high and say, I did it the right way.
Really well said. I love the Rocky analogy. I think you nailed that. And you're right about the hard work thing, because even hard work gets politicized. Well, like, hard work doesn't guarantee success, but it guarantees you good character. That's a really good way of putting it.
We don't very often get athletes and teams that we love because of how they are. We generally love their success. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's something really admirable about that. But in the end, we kind of don't expect them to be great folks. Like, we don't need them to be our friends. No. I think there was a time in our culture we did where we wanted these people to be like everyday folks who just had an extraordinary skill. But I think we've gotten comfortable with that. With great power usually comes great dickery.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
to borrow a phrase from Spider-Man and to adjust it for the times. Yeah. But with great power with these guys came great character. When you would see, like, Vlad's on first base and he's trying to calm Bo down and he's saying, he's giving him the just take a deep breath sign. He's not yelling at him. He's up there with him. We all know what that's like. Of course he wants Bo to succeed, but it's just like that crazy closeness where he's just saying, okay, dude, take a moment, do your thing. You know, it's not like LeBron yelling at his teammates, why didn't you get me the ball?
Yeah.
It was kind of the opposite of that. And we saw that from all of these players towards each other. So when you say that you're not sure how to begin, I think I know how to begin, which is what we saw can never be duplicated. It was so incredibly disappointing, but it was meaningful in a different way than winning.
It was. It was
for me.
No, it's a great way of putting it. It's just, this is every level of hard. This is every level of hard, because this was a Cinderella story, but in the end, like, they outplayed the Dodgers. It's one thing we're like, well, we got kind of lucky and we probably shouldn't have made it. No. The Blue Jays, by all statistical measurement, they were the better team. Now, often in sports, the better team doesn't always win. But in a 7-game series, usually the better team wins. It's the one game. That's why this one hurts more than, say, in the NFL. Because it's a one-off. It's a one-off. Anything can happen. You head the whole buildup. So I think that's the first part that really hurts. And then all the opportunities to win game 7, being up 4-2, bases loaded, one out. And by the way, I haven't read any of the discourse. I have avoided all of it. I haven't read one game 7 recap. I have avoided it on Twitter, on Thread, on Blue Sky. Even on the Bill Simmons podcast, you can look to see him and Cousin Sal where they guess the lines, the NFL. I saw they talked about the Blue Jays. I know where they stopped talking about the Blue Jays, and that's where I listen. On the Dan Le Batard show, every time the description says they look back at Game 7 and Dan does his grief-eating thing, oh my God, the pain, the emotion, I'm going to avoid all of it. That's how much I want to avoid all of it.
Well, this is classic Matt versus Bob.
Yeah.
Because you see that and you run from the pain.
Yes.
You don't like it.
Nope.
It doesn't make you feel fulfilled in any way.
It's not going to help me grow as a person. I will run towards the pain when it comes to real drama. In this one, I want to ignore it.
Matt, I'm a Catholic. Mm-hmm. It's a complicated relationship I have with Catholicism. Absolutely. But have you ever noticed what the Catholic symbol is? It's not exactly a run from pain kind
right,
of religion.
Sorry. Yeah, no, I was trying to think of something. Yeah, it's just the cross and the nails and all of that.
You know, we get pretty comfortable with life isn't always what you want. The city rallied around this team in a way that I've never seen a city rally around a team before.
Because it had everything. It had stars, young stars, the old guy trying for one last chance, the guy coming back from Tommy John to prove himself. Like, every sports cliche was on this roster where at some points it's like, no. This is not a, we're a try hard, gritty team. No, there's elite talent. And then there was the, oh my God, look at all these gritty fellas and they're doing well. And you know, they're beating up on guys to make 10 times more.
It wasn't the Oakland A's Moneyball team.
No.
They gave Vladimir Guerrero $500 million this year. They weren't just like scratching out wins with walks and hope and determination. And they're the fifth largest payroll in all of MLB. But what this really did, it was interesting. It introduced a lot of people to the game of baseball. And I don't mean like they've never been baseball fans before. I don't know that we've ever seen baseball played this well in a really long time. You know, the game became the switch and the shift and, you know, launch trajectories and home runs or strikeouts.
Yeah, it was home run, strikeout, or walk, and that was it. That was right. the three result plays.
The analytics of the game kind of reduced it to a series of things you're shooting for and just a very small window and just repeating those time and time again. And it became very predictable. But what we had here was baseball at its best, which is such an incredibly open tableau. So many different things can happen. And we saw, just particularly with the Jays, scratching out runs, you know, moving runners over, like just the joy. Like for years I heard, oh, you never bunt. Bunting is stupid. It's a waste of an out. But I'm watching this, and John Schneider would call for the bunt, and it was like, yes, this is how baseball has always been played, because they're just trying to get that one run. They're not trying to load up the bases so somebody with a super, fast bat can hit one out for a three-run home run, because that's how you win baseball. This was more storytelling. And I remember my buddy Ihor, who came up on the last pod, was talking to his wife. She was like, why is he trying to get out? He's not trying to get out. He's trying to move the runner over. She learned something about baseball that's different than, oh, home run, and they all come in.
Yeah.
The game has become so simplified in that regard, and this was baseball at its most complex, its richest, its deepest. It was really baseball as an art.
And art and richness. Compare, John Schneider, series against Seattle, going to the mound. Max Scherzer yelling at him. He's like, oh, yeah, you know what you're doing. Compare that was when they pulled Barrios a couple of years earlier in the playoffs in the third inning and brought in Kikuchi. And that was, and we got angry because that was a management decision made by analytics before the game had started.
Rojas was playing because Dave Roberts had a hunch. He had a hunch. Oh. Andy Pajas makes that crazy ninth inning catch off of Ernie Clement where he's colliding into the other outfielder and basically does an over-the-shoulder bouncing off a guy with the winning run ready to score. In any given World Series, that would be the craziest play. I'm not even sure it was in the top five for this World Series. But Andy Pajas wasn't in the game until Dave Roberts said, okay, now defensive replacement time. The micro decisions that have to be made in baseball. Football is close to this in the sense that but football and baseball have something in common in that you reload every play and play it again. Mm-hmm. So there's time for strategy. What's a coach going to do in hockey when the puck's moving back and forth for three straight minutes? Yell at them, hey, do smart things. What's going to happen in basketball unless you call a timeout? It's continuous action. We love it for that, but it's not cerebral. Yeah, those sports aren't cerebral.
It's a different aesthetic.
They're kinetic. Yeah. They're built on transition, particularly hockey. But baseball is the most cerebral of the games because literally every time a new play starts, you have to think of all of the outcomes. You are constantly measuring probabilities from pitch to pitch. I think what people really fell in love with was, and I think Dan and Buck did a great job of this, explaining he should go to this pitch here. He should go to this pitch here. Because you're now inside the folds of the curtains. You know, you're in the details of the game. And when the stakes are this high, every single decision is life or death for this game.
Yeah. And it was build up, and every game is a build up. And the worst parts are everyone else gets to go home and move on.
Mm-hmm.
You're a fan of the Brewers or the Reds or
the Phillies who are disappointed. Right.
You have your own disappointments, but at the end you're like, oh my God, remember that World Series? That World Series was crazy. Pause. What do we want to have for lunch? If you're a Dodger fan, it's that World Series was crazy. My hand hurts because I'm high-fiving everyone and I'm filled with joy. And then there's Blue Jay fans. That World Series was crazy, and it still hurts. They had that gets to stay there forever. Like that, this is now in the, like, they'll be the pantheon of the worst losses, the toughest losses. And it was always, we always had the thing like, oh my God, imagine how bad it would have felt to be those fans, and right, they lost the championship like that. Now we're those fans.
This reminds me a bit of the Tennessee Titans Rams World Super Bowl, where it was lost at the end when the Titans were stopped at the 1 yard line, and they would have won. But that's different because that happened at the end of one game.
One game.
This is at the end of seven games, and one of those games was actually two games long. So your intensity is stretched out literally over a week and a half.
And after every win or loss, you now have 24, sometimes 48 hours to feel great about your team or feel stressed about your team. So it's the emotional buildup of seven games, not a bye week.
Okay, you know, so let's play this game here, Matt, because I'm going to play therapist to your broken-hearted fan, okay? And the game is called Do You Wish It Didn't Happen? Do you wish they didn't make the World Series?
Better to have loved and lost than never have loved at all.
Do you wish that they wouldn't have gone to Los Angeles and won two of the three, coming home up 3-2?
The answer is obviously, I'm glad it all happened. I'm glad we got to a game seven.
It's not obviously that. Because it would have been easier.
It would have been easier.
If they had been swept, or if it was five games, as I predicted, because I thought this would be a squash. I thought this was the King Kong Bundy versus SD Jones. Splash him after 9 seconds. Give me the five count. I thought this thing was a wrap before it even started. Would it have been better if they'd lost in five? Would you feel better about it now?
I would have felt better about it now. But down the road, no. Because by going seven, the Jays got historic. Just like Rocky didn't win, that was a historic fight where he at least got a draw or whatever against Apollo. So no, you want the seven games because it becomes memorable. The problem is the final memory is such a bad one.
I actually thought the loss in 85 was more crushing. The loss to the Kansas City Royals, because they were up three games to one.
They were up 3-1.
And they lost three games in a row, and you watched it slipping away over multiple days. And then that final game, which I believe ended at 6-1, there's a 3-run home run that goes over the right field fence, and Jesse Barfield's just watching it go, and you're like, I forget the name, it was the catcher from the Royals who hit it. His name escapes me, Sandberg. Mm-hmm. Sandberg? No, I can't recall right now. But regardless, there was just this, like, the cake finally fell. You knew it was over. And that never happened in this. It went down to the last fucking play.
Counterpoint. What happened to the Jays against Kansas City was the ALCS. This was the World Series.
Yep. Stakes are higher.
100%.
This is an epic loss, but it's not an epic fail. And I think that's the difference.
Yes.
That's why I'm okay with it. Because nobody goofed it up. Like, people are mad at Isaiah Kiner-Falefa because maybe he didn't take enough of a lead. But then lots of baseball guys chimed in and said, well, you know, you don't want to be doubled off a third to create an out that way. So it was actually, and maybe you can debate it. But it wasn't like a bonehead play. The Addison Barger at the end of game six was a little bit boneheaded.
Yep.
But this wasn't a game or even a series that was defined by mistakes. It was defined by excellence.
Yeah, I don't look at this all as failure. And I thank God. I saw the IKF stuff, and I'm like, nope, moving on.
Yeah.
You know, just like...
Those are Leafs fans.
What's that? Yeah.
I'm actually serious about this.
Yeah.
My wife said to me, she goes, the difference between this and when the Leafs lose is that Leafs fans are so mad and so bitter about their history that their instinct is to immediately jump to blame. It doesn't matter what happened or who it happened to. If we didn't win, I hate you guys. You're always doing this to me. And she said, Jays fans, even though Jays fans have had some pretty heartbreaking losses, they're not like that. They're not as quick to blame.
The other level, and you're right. That's a great point by Sandra. That, yeah, there is a difference.
Not that there's no blame. Everyone was mad at John Schneider after that famous loss to Seattle that you referenced. But blame is part of the Leafs makeup. The Leafs fan was born to blame.
And part of me says, I can't blame him for being born to blame.
Well, it's been a long time.
You know, all the time, blah, blah, blah. We don't need to do that today. The other tough thing is, would we say the, if not the Dodgers, the best team in the National League was probably Philadelphia?
I would say that for sure. And maybe Milwaukee.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, go with either of those teams. Part of it also is, like, if they had lost Philly or Milwaukee, we wouldn't have felt bad. Like, oh, Milwaukee's never won it. Okay. But it's because the Dodgers' excellence, part of the Dodgers' excellence is they've got the best TV, local TV contract, so they get all the revenue.
Having the Scrooge McDuck money fights, man.
Exactly. Like, that is part of it. And again, we recognize this team drafts really well. They scout really well. So many players drafted by the Dodgers are starting all across Major League Baseball.
We talked about this before, how they splash the cash around, but they don't do it stupidly. They spend the money on, and they're going to get Kyle Tucker next year, apparently, and they're just going to make themselves better because they have tons of dough. They got so much money and they know how to spend it. And I'm not sure that the Jays will be back. Think that they could, I think they're in the contention to make the playoffs, but this felt like a bit of a best case scenario. Well, a lot of guys were playing better than they usually are.
Yeah. Well, what you hope for is that all the guys, like, you hope between Clement and Barger, one of them breaks through.
Yes.
You hope that, like, that one
of
those two.
And your Savage, you hope, turns into a good young starter who can sustain that over a whole year.
Yeah. Well, the difference is, at least your Savage, this feels like what a star looks like.
Yep.
So
it does feel that way. But baseball, as we've talked about many times, you know, we had the Lansing three, and in the end, none of them are going to Cooperstown.
Also, Mark Pryor's greatest success is as a pitching coach for the Dodgers.
Right.
At one point, Mark Pryor was him and Kerry Wood.
Him and Kerry Wood were the
phenoms. Yes.
They were so incredible. There was Generation K with the Mets. Mm-hmm. And in the end, you know, Isringhausen and Pulsifer, and, you know, where did those guys go? Like, it's just a game that is so hard to know what the future is going to look like. Pitchers are almost like goalies in the sense that you have to just sort of say most of them are going to flash out.
Yeah, so that was the other one. Is like you were so close to beating a team that was supposed to win.
But here's the thing, and I'm gonna use the Leafs as a counterpoint in this one a little bit. One of the things that drives us crazy about the Leafs is not that they're losing, but the sense that they're underperforming or performing under where they were during the regular season in the playoffs. When it matters the most, they offer the least.
Yes.
And that's what's driven people nuts about this iteration of the team. Most of these guys weren't that great during the regular season. Like, how they actually won the division is kind of amazing. Like, Scherzer didn't have a great year.
Nope.
You know, Andreas Jimenez was not good. And then he was actually quite good in the playoffs. Like, they were, like, everybody showed up and played better than they really were. We talked about Vladdy and how Vladdy had a kind of a good but not great year.
Mm-hmm.
And then for six glorious weeks, he was the best baseball player in the world, the best position player anyway. Scherzer goes out and delivers these really great starts. We didn't see that all that much during the year. Like, everybody got better when it mattered more. And I think that drew us all in. That's why when I say the city loved this team differently than it has a lot of other teams, it's because we didn't really know them. But we had a sense that they are showing up when it matters the most. And that was exhilarating.
There was just so many moments of heroism by the Blue Jays against the Yankees, against Seattle, against the Dodgers. And, you know, like, Seattle was a small favorite. The Dodgers were a large favorite. Yankees and Jays kind of considered even. So there was heroism against teams perceived to be at least as good or not better than the Blue Jays, which is in stark contrast to the Maple Leafs, which is one reason why everyone loved this Blue Jays team, because we're used to that Leafs team in the playoffs.
And I would argue that this run was a little different than the championship run for the 2019 Raptors. The series against Philly was incredibly close and exciting. And it came down to Kawhi's miracle four bounce on the rim shot.
Yeah.
Then they were down two to Milwaukee and pulled it out of the fire and won. And there was a real sense of destiny. But the truth is, the Golden State team they beat was seriously depleted. And in that brief moment when Kevin Durant came back in, mm-hmm. I guess it was what, game five?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. And he was really dominant. And you just felt like, even now, we might just lose this series because they're getting their quality back, like, even into just that one guy. And then he went down again and they were kind of undermanned, but they were very banged up. It's not like Ollie Frazier. This was Ollie Frazier. Mm-hmm. The Jays against the Dodgers was two teams playing at their best for seven straight games. No quarter asked, no excuses, your best versus my best. Again, there was just this sense of a movable object meets irresistible force, and something at 11 innings. They couldn't even decide it in 9 innings. 11 innings. The bases loaded twice with the winning run 90 feet away and the winning run being thrown out at home, and that particular IKF like 3 inches, 4 inches from winning in the bottom of the ninth. Like, it was so absurdly dramatic. Michael Bay would be embarrassed to sit in a Hollywood studio and say, here's what I think the ending should be.
Michael Bay would go into the edit bay and go, guys, tone this down. Okay?
Yeah, guys, come on. No one's going to buy this.
Yeah.
So, yes. Yeah. And I kind of love what Cathal Kelly wrote in The Globe. I don't know if you had a chance to see it down in Mexico.
No, I've avoided. Yeah. Bob, I mean this. I've avoided. You know,
your media blackout.
Yeah. Oh, I'm total. You know, when you turn on the computer and then there's all the bait articles, like, see which famous stars were actually started as extras. And like all those ones. And you never click on it, but then the 10th time you click on something, I've seen those for the Blue Jays. Jays, and I'm like, no, I've avoided every clickbait, everything I have avoided. So what did Cathal Kelly write?
I have read everything I can, and he wrote the best thing. And the gist of it was, you're not really a great sports city until you've had a great loss. And his point was, we bitch and moan about 4-1 to the Boston Bruins because it looked like they were going to make it. And he's like, guys, it was the quarterfinals. It was not a great sports loss. It was a disappointing loss for your franchise. But in the great scheme of things, it happens every fucking year that somebody loses in the quarter. Like, this was a moment that can never be erased from modern sports. And he said, like, you know what? The Yankees, they've got the 3-0 collapse to the Red Sox.
4-0-4.
Yeah.
Oh, 3-0. No, but sorry.
They were up 3-0.
Yeah, sorry. Right?
Red Sox had Bill Buckner. Mm-hmm. And if you look at all of these great franchises, there is a moment in which things could not have gone worse. It was the ultimate victory, and then it was the ultimate defeat. So in a way, he was almost like, congratulations, guys. You've graduated into what it's like to be a really, really meaningful sports team in your city. And you don't have to fake it with a 4-1 quarterfinals loss anymore.
Cathal Kelly is a great writer.
So great. Maybe the best right now.
He's up there.
He's so good.
He's a great writer.
Beautiful writer.
And he's an important part of the whole sports landscape in Toronto and in Canada, because it's Globe Mail. So that's a global, you know, obviously a national paper. Cathal Kelly can also fuck off. And he can, listen, if he wants to go graduate to This Sucks University, that's fine. Okay, that's fine.
But sports isn't about pleasure. Sports is about engagement.
We were so close to pleasure. We were so close to the ultimate
you
pleasure.
You are about pleasure.
Yes.
But that's not what sports is about. Sports is about getting sucked in.
Stupid.
It is the stupidest. But anything that involves dopamine is stupid. Gambling's stupid. It's fucking fun when you win, though.
It is.
Did you ever see The Twilight Zone where the cheap hood gets shot and he goes to what he thinks is heaven and he can't lose and everybody gives him everything he wants? And within like a fraction of eternity, he's so bored. And he's like, I thought heaven would be different. And his guy, who actually looks like Jeff Pollock, oddly, is the demonic helper. He looks a bit like Jeff Pollock, but wearing like a white suit, like kind of like a Bond villain. He goes, heaven. This is the other place.
So it's
hell is not losing. Hell is not caring.
You're not wrong.
Did you say yeah wrong?
No, I said you're not wrong.
You know I'm right. It just sucks.
Yeah. Listen, I'm greedy. Okay, fuck it.
You've built your life around enjoyment.
Yeah.
Everybody loves you for it. Mm-hmm. You are the happiest guy going.
That's right.
But when things are tight, that's when you turn to Bob. Because Bob is dark.
Yeah, this podcast is way more for you than me.
This is way. If we had won, it's.
Oh my God.
That's all happy. Oh my God, the tacos I had.
Oh, no. And we were at, the sports bar was horrible. Just the food was shit. The service was worse. But I had the bottle ready to order. I saw, they got some old bottle Rioja. Or is anyone going to get champagne? It's going to do all that. And didn't do any of that.
I remember something bad happened. I lost somebody. I can't remember exactly who it was in my life at that time. But Sandra's old boss, Bob Colbert, Irish guy, mm-hmm. From Ireland. And he was so sweet. And he was kind of a death specialist in the way that only the Irish can be, because they have such deep hearts and deep souls. It's like they come to life when something incredibly important has happened, good or bad. And he just looked at me and he gave me a copy of a book and he shook my hand. He said, you know, it's going to be fucking awful. But you'll be all right. And I thought, who else could say this except for Bob and his Irish accent? You know, when it's great, you want Matt to show up with the wine.
Yep.
and pour everybody shots in like those little Dixie cups, mm-hmm. you know, and just have an office party.
Yep.
And when things are bad, mm-hmm. you want Irish Bob to show up. By the way, I'm 1/8 Irish.
So you can do it.
And yeah, so I've got it in me yeah. at the very least. And you want me to say, oh, it's going to be fucking awful. But in the end, it'll be worth it.
Listen, I can do that as well. I've done this with people like when they've been breakups and things like that. I'm like, today is supposed to be bad, but take comfort in knowing 5 months, 6 months from now, things will be better and have hope in that. And that's fine. But I'm and also, Bob, like you're getting the trauma dump from me because I haven't talked about it. Like maybe brief, like literally brief moments with Amy later on that same night where I feel bad for the person at the local convenience store where I walk behind the counter because there was a couple bottles of wine and I grabbed the best of the shittiest. And then we had some drinks and we talked about it a bit, but that's it. And I'm going to ask my producer, how much do I need to talk about this on Wednesday? Because this happened on Saturday. And now there's going to be a Leaf game tomorrow night. Raptors are taking on Milwaukee. NFL, MLB free agency. Like, how much do I have to address the greatest loss in the history of Toronto sports on Toronto Sports Radio, but it's Wednesday?
Well, you know, Matt, that's where the gold is.
Have we not moved on? Can we not move on?
The poem for today, Bob's poem. Is very apropos of this. And I will read it, and then you can make your decision what you're going to do on tomorrow's show. You ready? Mm-hmm. It's by Emily Dickinson, poem 372. After great pain, a formal feeling comes. The nerves sit ceremonious like tombs. The stiff heart questions, was it he that bore in yesterday or centuries before? The feet, mechanical, go round a wooden way of ground, of air or aught, regardless grown, a quartz contentment. Like a stone. This is the hour of lead, remembered, if outlived, as freezing persons recollect the snow. First chill, then stupor, then the letting go. So do it Wednesday and then let it go for Thursday, because Thursday is the NFL.
Yeah, no, I know. I trust me. I've already started.
People are going to want to know what you think.
Yeah.
I wanted to know what you think.
Yeah. It's just, like, it's funny. If I go and look at all the playoff losses, I have all my notes. Mm-hmm. I have tons of notes. I then get the historical things and the big picture, little picture. And this one, no notes. Like just
couldn't do it because you were at the bar or?
But the next day I could have.
Yeah,
Next day easily could have gone through. I could have gone through everything. And yeah, I mean, you know, in the end, this will be better to have loved and lost than never have loved at all. Like if I was going to summarize it in one sentence, it's that.
Which actually is not best case scenario. It's the lesser of two evils. Mm-hmm. I hate the lesser of two evils. I heard a great line actually about Dianne Feinstein, you know, the Democratic senator from California.
Yep.
She had done something. She yelled at some kids about climate change and it was a real asshole move. But someone sent out on Twitter, Dianne Feinstein is what happens when you choose the lesser of two evils 10 times in a row. I thought that was a pretty good burn. On a politician.
Yeah. Also, a Democrat always concerned about the climate. Come on. 50 years ago, you'd said we'd be doomed in 20. Anyway. All right.
We can talk about what the Jays do next, or we can actually just move on to the Leafs, because I actually wanted to bring back an old bit. Leafs in six words.
Oh, Leafs in six. Ah.
When you and I were on the air together, we used to, after every game, we would come up with six words that we thought defined the night's game, the game from the night before.
By the way, putting a bow on the Blue Jays, but this is a transition into the Maple Leafs.
Okay.
That's the other tough part about all of it. It's like, oh God, we now don't have the Blue Jays. We need another local team to bring us happy. And then you watch.
I don't know if it's going to be these guys.
You watch the Maple Leafs like, and we're like, guys, you are not designed to help us right now. You know,
you didn't read the room, guys.
You did not read the room. It's
bad,
like
a bad night to start out like dull for 40 minutes.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Like, OK, but yeah.
OK, so you're ready for the. Well, that's what the Leafs in six words is about. They make you wait for it.
God, yeah.
For 40 minutes. I, like you, thought, OK, I got to get back out there. It's like after a bad divorce. OK, I'm going to shake it off and I'm going to get out there and date. And then it's like, oh, this is the worst. I don't know what that's like, but I hear that's what it's like. They were awful. And then, of course, in the third period, it was really quite exciting. I was rooting against them in the third period. I thought, you know what? Fuck you. You don't deserve this win. I don't care how great you look, William Nylander. I don't care about you, Bobby McMahon, with your winning goal. I don't care, Austin Matthews, with your stoic face, but I'm so good. I was like, you know what? You guys went out and for 40 minutes embarrassed yourselves. You don't deserve to feel good about this at the end of the night. And I hope that there was no music in that dressing room after they won.
I doubt there was. I mean, you know, like Berube was pissed. Matthews said all the right things afterwards.
I don't want to hear what's unacceptable. You know what makes something unacceptable? You know what makes it unacceptable? When you accept it over and over and over again. That's the thing about they make you wait for it.
And they have accepted it.
They accept that they're just going to suck for part of the game. Guess what? You don't have to. You could try the whole thing. Give it a go. You might like it. 60 minutes. See how it feels. Try it on.
Here's my main concern with the Maple Leafs. And I've been diving into the Maple Leafs.
Out of necessity. Well, it's also like the dark corner of your mind that isn't occupied by baseball right now.
Yeah, no, trust me. I'm going into everything else. By the way, tomorrow night, Spurs-Lakers.
Yeah.
That's going to be good.
Yeah.
Also, NBA, Morant, you've lost the joy, just like Jimmy Butler lost the joy of losing the joy playing. Guys, also read the room. When you keep talking about you've lost the joy, if you wonder why casuals are walking away from basketball, it's because you guys have lost the joy. Anyway, we'll get there. Maple Leafs, my main concern is this. Is there any other way they can do well unless Matthews, Nylander, and Nyes together? Is that the only way?
They basically have the same formula as they did last year, just without Mitch Marner.
And if that's it...
So they're top heavy with less top.
And this was supposed to be the year of balance. This was supposed to be the year of, okay, no Marner, money to spend. And again, it's all...
Well, they didn't spend it that well.
Well, they spent as best they could.
No. No, they didn't. Because they didn't need to spend it all. Why do you have to spend to the cap every year?
Yeah, they do have money.
Why don't you keep your powder dry and wait for something to come up? Because now they're still fucking handcuffed because they're basically spent right to the cap. They got a bunch of players that you... Like, how many David Kampfs do you need to overpay and stuff your roster with in order to say we're really trying? Hey, guys, take a step back. I wrote this note down. Mm. They are closer to the Raptors than they are the Jays.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Absolutely. And the Raptors need to rethink this, too, where it's like, guys... We went out and got a bunch of players, and they're not good enough. They're not necessarily bad players, but the combination of these guys doesn't work. The top-end talent isn't high enough. The floor is too low. You're not going to win like this. But the Leafs Leafs, so stupidly, after Marner left, and they have this cash that they all of a sudden have to spend, we're like, well, we're going to show that we can win this year. Guys, you weren't going to win this year. All you did was tether yourself to a roster that's worse and still expensive. It was a stupid decision that was made the way all teams screw themselves, which is when they feel we have to be this when they're not actually that.
I'd have to pull up, the salary cap. But, you know, I mean, to me, the worst signing was probably the Max Domi deal. And that was done, you know, I would say the Domi deal was right now the worst one of all of them. Like, the Michelli or Dakota Joshua. Like, it's not like they spent a ton there.
You know, but a $2 and $3 million six times...
Oh, I know.
Is all of a sudden two great players.
And they have cap space. My biggest issue with this team is... It goes back to the lack of toughness, forecheck, and all that. But I don't think the Leafs can ever be anything but soft when it's Matthews... and Morgan Rielly and William Nylander. Mm-hmm. Like, Matthews is their leader in ice time, even more than any defenseman. Morgan Riley's number two in ice time. Nylander is actually playing a little bit less than Matthew Nyes right now at forward. Like, I think, like, to me, the main thing is just, I don't know how this team's going to be anything but soft.
We're $626,000 under the cap.
See, there you go. $626,000.
Yeah, we could easily get some popcorn for that. Yes, this is the uncomfortable thing we're facing, which is those guys just don't seem to have that winning DNA. Whatever that is, it feels like such a cop-out. What is winning DNA? And if analytics taught us anything, everything is quantifiable. But I don't think that's true. I don't think that's true, and I don't think that's true, especially in the playoffs. But it's also not true in that when you say something's unacceptable and then you do it again next game, it's not unacceptable, is it?
So
you have to hate losing. You have to hate it. You have to be almost like your body has to refuse it, like it's refusing a baboon heart that someone tried to put in your chest. It just can't be about losing. You know, you and I've said this about you many, many times. The most important thing you ever brought to Off the Record was every single day you came in and tried to make the best show we could do.
Yeah.
Every single day. Now, your contributions were excellent in the sense you're a smart guy, you're a good writer, you did a lot of things very well. But it wasn't the most important contribution. What it was when you're standing shoulder to shoulder with someone who's trying to make the show the best it can be, you have one of two options. Pull up your own socks or let that person down. Mm-hmm. And if you're the kind of person who would let that person down, you probably shouldn't be in this locker room. But there's too many guys who aren't showing up and saying, this is like unacceptable and meaning it. It is acceptable. They've accepted this every time.
And this comes to the main players. Like that's
who else
it.
Is going to do it?
Yeah.
Like is Dakota Joshua, who's been in a Leafs jersey now for what, 13 games? Is he supposed to say, guys, I know you've been here for 8 years, but this is unacceptable. No. It has to. You'd like Morgan Rielly to be that guy, but maybe the season he's having isn't good enough. And maybe none of these guys are just like that. Carlos Delgado, you have often said he is the superstar that this city never embraced. But we were always frustrated with him because he just seemed a little too happy to be a good player. He never seemed mad enough that they kept finishing third. And people would say, look, he leads one by example, but two, it's not that guy. He's excellent. He's best player on the team. He's one of the best players in the league. But you don't look to Carlos to say, guys, this doesn't fucking work. And if you're not going to do it, you're out. He's not that guy. You know, I wrote down here, who's the heart of this team? This is what it comes to. And I don't mean the best player. Mm-hmm. Who is the heart of this team?
Closest I could think of is maybe Chris Tanev, and he's now out with a concussion.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know.
Who's the heart of the team? Like, you look back at some of the other Leafs teams that were really great. Doug Gilmore, Wendell Clark, Darcy Tucker, Shane Corson, Joe Nieuwendyk, even though he was banged up as a Leaf, had that incredible playoff pedigree and had that gravitas.
And even Sundin was more than physical enough.
They've tried to bring it in. They've tried to bring in Joe Thornton or Patrick Marleau, but it's got to be your guys. Like, you can't bring in the heart. You can't just buy it and plug it in. It has to come from the guys who are developed through your system. This is what we're learning. If it's not there, they're the wrong guys. They're there to support somebody else.
Yeah.
On another team. That's what you got to realize.
And we also, like, we knew this team would not be as good. Like, you can't lose, and you were never going to be able to keep Marner. You're never able to. The Maple Leafs were never going to. He was out.
Yeah. He was out for the last 2 years.
Yeah. I have no blame on Treliving or Shanahan or.
Well, they didn't trade him when they had the chance.
Yeah.
And then his no trade kicked in. Yes. So you got to kind of blame him for that.
For that. For a year. Yes. But from the moment the trade deadline thing, yeah. So. But then I wonder, how much do they know? How much do they know they would not be able to sign him again?
I don't know. We won't know.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine the people who actually did know the answer to that are probably not saying. But you had to think, if the DNA of this team is problematic, you've got to address it. And the funny thing is, even when Marner left, they didn't address it. They're like, we need this team to have a different feeling, a different core or whatever. And then they brought three of the four guys back. They brought back Morgan Rielly. They brought back Anthony Stolarz. Like, you did some changes. Like, everyone's like, oh, this team needs time to adjust. What? The third line? A couple guys on the fourth line need to adjust. One winger in the top six needs to adjust. You brought back all your key pieces except for Marner. This is the same frickin' team. The same coach, most of the same guys, the same key players, save for one.
What's the heat level, I wonder, going to be on Matthews?
What's it going to be on Berube?
Berube will be like the coach one, that's fine. Coaches come and go. Matthews is still the star player who signed for I think, 3 years.
I think the truth is he's just going to be this team's Carlos Delgado.
Mm-hmm. It could be.
You know, Carlos Delgado put up numbers that are Hall of Fame worthy consideration, at least. Matthews is clearly an excellent player. He scored last night.
By the way, the difference is Delgado was stuck on a team that wasn't spending anywhere close to what the Red Sox and the Yankees are doing.
Yeah, agreed.
And that's why I'm going to give him more of a pass than I will on the Leaf Stars. And I just wonder, after seeing like just so much fucking heroism from the baseball team for the last... Since August, since they were fighting to win the American League East. And to go from the compare and contrast of that to what we see from the Leafs.
You've got new administration with the Leafs. I mean, new in the sense that they're the last couple of years. And they're inheriting an old iteration of mm-hmm. the team roster-wise, right? You're selling corporate boxes. You're selling sponsorships. You're selling to your fan base, hey, we're going to jack up prices on these tickets. You're not selling success. You're not selling optimism particularly. I think that this organization is making the same mistake that big organizations always fall prey to, which is the fear of stepping backwards. When they did it with Babcock and that whole blow it up, get rid of Kessel, we're just going to make the DNA new at the beginning of the Shanna plan, for a couple of years, it was really promising. It didn't work out.
Nope.
It probably mostly didn't work out because of COVID and the cap. Like, it was just a really freaking weird time to do a rebuild. Plus, rebuilds are hard and they're slower than anyone would like. We're not rebuilding anymore, which means that the arrow has gone as high as it can go and is starting to come back to earth without some major new transfusion, which they just did not do because they're afraid to step back. This is my opinion, but I don't see anything on the ice that suggests to me that this team is somehow going to be better in a year or two than it is now.
Oh, no. Right now, there's nothing. And
they feel like the Raptors post-championship. They're treading water, and now they're starting to sink.
It's funny, with both the basketball and the hockey team, all we're doing is we're looking for signs of life. And life means a deep playoff run. And both those organizations are in different places right now. But that's all we're looking for. And maybe we're not going to find it with the Maple Leafs.
Do you know what I think is one of the bellwethers of an organization that isn't really delivering? You care too much about the next man up, like the rookie that's ready to step in. Easton Cowan, well, maybe when he comes in, he's going to really put a charge into this team. You know what? I don't want anybody who's barely old enough to shave to be responsible for putting a charge into a team full of veterans. Nick Robertson was that guy for how long? You know, back in the day, Luke Shen was that guy. Your team's not that good if you're looking at who's coming up and saying, well, maybe they're going to save the situation.
In the end, a lot of this, it's like an A sport. How are your best players? You know, Matthews and Tavares and Nylander and Morgan Riley. And they're just not tough enough. That's it. They are not tough enough for what Berube wants and also for what winning hockey wants. And tough, to me, toughness is about how much time are you in your zone? How much time are you not in their zone? And right now, Jonas Siegel, I think it was Jonas, threw it on The Athletic. You know, the Maple Leafs are like 23rd in terms of time spent in the other team's zone. And, you know, that's...
So I wrote down this word.
Yeah.
And then I wrote down two subheadings. Pressure. And then the subheadings are retrieval and possession. Now, here's what I mean by that. Your job as a hockey team is to put pressure on the other team so that it yields opportunities for you. And to limit the amount of pressure that's being exerted on you so that you basically control the energy of the game. There's two ways in hockey primarily to achieve that. One is puck retrieval. You get the puck deep, and then you are such a hard force in retrieving that puck that you have the other team on its heels constantly, and you come away with possession. Or you can possess it carrying it into the zone, and the team has to basically be moving backwards to try and contain you. And the Leafs aren't good at either. I know which one they want to play. They want to play retrieval, and they went out and got a very heavy team. But they're slow, and they're not particularly great at puck battles. And so it looks to the eye like they should be good at this, but they're not really. Like, their makeup isn't. They're not. Even Marner was tenacious on the puck. Like, mm-hmm. He was a really ferocious defender in the sense that he was really an agitator.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he put pressure on guys to make mistakes. This team doesn't put pressure on you getting the puck back. And it doesn't put pressure on you when, like, they're terrible carrying it through the neutral zone. And getting rid of Marner just made them worse. Like, their defense is not built. Even Brad Treliving himself said, this defense, well, we'd probably like to get some puck movers more. And then they brought back all the same guys. Why would it get better? They're all 1 year older, and you didn't bring anything in that addresses the skill that you said you needed. Why would it get better? And then you've got Berube preaching a certain thing, and his players aren't like that. They're just not like that.
How do we end this on a happy note?
Do we have to?
We don't. We don't. Oh, we're not ending. But again, you know, the happiest thing I can say is at the very least, we've got a good friend in Jeff Pollock. You know, we got that.
I'm going to a Remembrance Day thing with him.
Oh, are you really?
Yeah, it's actually beautiful. He gives his everybody who works with him at his firm, they get the day off because, you know, he's very into the military, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I believe he's done.
Yeah, he's got his background is not just as a lawyer, but he's got a military background as well. Jeff Pollock, jeffpollock.com, Jeff for the G, jeffpollock.com. He is our lawyer. He is our sponsor. Sorry, continue with the story, but remember.
Well, no, he just said, do you want to come in, you know, because he knows, like, as much as I feel like a peacenik lefty, like I'm not, I have a lot of respect for the military. Mm-hmm. I kind of respect them the same way I do the cops, which is like, it's not an easy job and there are people who abuse it. And unfortunately, it'll probably always attract those kinds of people for certain reasons, but there's also a certain dignity to the work. And, you know, you're putting the most important thing on the line, which is your life. So yeah.
Very nice.
Yeah. How long do we have? Because I got a few things here.
We got about 7 minutes.
We can do dot, dot, dot around the Raptors, or I can give you In Honor of the Odyssey by Christopher Nolan, which is coming out next year.
Oh, I'm so excited for it.
I'm so excited.
Oh, my God.
Let's end it on this happy note, okay?
Yeah, let's end on the happy note.
All right, so I saw ads for this starting to come out, yeah. And you know, it's the last time I felt this way was Endgame, Avengers Endgame, where you just wish it was 8 months from now.
Right, yeah.
I don't want to wait. Mm-hmm. I want this now. So I thought I would do a top 10 best movies that are based on books.
Ooh,
The Odyssey is based on Homer's Odyssey.
Of course.
Right? Arguably the first piece of Western literature.
Yeah, the first truly great piece of literature.
Okay, so things that didn't make the cut, Ten Commandments. I think you know the book that's based on.
Yep.
Gone with the Wind, mm-hmm. Jurassic Park, All the President's Men. Rosemary's Baby, written
by
Ira Levin.
Wow, these are the ones getting left off?
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Wizard of Oz, Gone Girl, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Coraline, Matilda, Carrie, and Arrival, which is based on a short story by Ted Chiang.
Arrival is in my top 10 greatest movies of all time.
Isn't it great?
Wizard of Oz might be considered the greatest of all time.
Yep.
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, the first movie that won Best Picture, Director, Actor, Actress, and Editor. All of those movies and many others are on the outside looking in.
Yes. Well, part of the reason why the five took the shape it did was it can't just be the quality of the movie. Mm-hmm. It has to be the relationship to the book.
Right.
Okay. Which either had to be immaculate or strained.
Okay.
Fair like, point. For example, number five for me was The Shining, mm-hmm. which is based on a Stephen King novel. But apparently King and Kubrick hated each other.
Yep.
And King basically disavowed himself of the movie because it changed a lot of key facts. That King had put in, like it's kind of an adaptation of a certain sort. But my favorite thing is Kubrick, who would be very engaged when he was doing pre-production, calls up Stephen King one night. Like imagine you're Stephen King, you're in bed, phone rings, it's Stanley Kubrick. Okay, so say hello.
Hello?
Do you believe in God?
Yes.
I thought so. Click.
That's what he would do?
No, that was a conversation they really had.
Oh my God. So he just called up Stephen King and did that.
Stephen King.
What an, like Stanley Kubrick, I love you, but what an asshole.
It's so funny. Number four, Apocalypse Now, mm-hmm. which is its own story, but it's drawn from Heart of Darkness. And when you watch it, and what's great about it is the way it actually turns Heart of Darkness into a film by Joseph Conrad. Number three is Jaws. And this could have been Jurassic Park.
53 minutes. First.
I also needed to make sure it got in there. But here's the thing. The novel by Peter Benchley was a sensation. It was a bestseller. Two things made me do this. One, there was a plot in the novel where the mayor is tied into the mafia. And that's why he wants to keep the beaches open because he's got to pay off mafia debts. And two, Hooper was having an affair with Mrs. Brody.
Right. Yeah. I heard about that.
And Spielberg was like, yeah, we're not going there.
Yeah.
Both good decisions.
Very good decisions.
But the other thing is it solved a real problem, which is how do you take something that is unfilmable and film it? The problems with the shark had to be solved with filmmaking. So you couldn't just have the shark swimming around. And so the fact that the shark doesn't really appear in a meaningful way until the final reel is a tribute to filmmaking versus novel writing.
Yeah.
So the reason I put it here is the adaptation was actually making it a film instead of a story.
No argument.
And the best example of that is Lord of the Rings.
Agreed.
Which is my number two.
Yeah.
Like, just what Peter Jackson was able to do with the technology available to him, animated a world that most of us lived in as kids for decades. And he just made it seem so wow. And then number one for me was actually The Godfather.
Mm-hmm.
Huge story by Mario Puzo, who co-wrote the screenplay. And it feels, of all the movies, I feel it's the most novelistic. It just feels like episodic, told the way the great 19th century story novelists told their stories, you know. And you chart the depth of each character in all the fine details that Coppola bakes in. But in the end, it's just such a great page turner. Like, there's no moment of The Godfather that doesn't set up the next moment. It is a relentlessly taught story over 3.5 hours. Only the way like Tolstoy could do that, or Dickens could do that. Like, the Godfather's long.
Oh yeah.
It's long, but it's never dull. There are no let-ups. There are no respots. There are no arm bars. So I kind of feel like The Godfather is the most novelistic movie.
I'm not going to argue. Godfather won, you know, won the Oscar. Lord of the Rings, the third one, Fellowship of the King, Return of the King, excuse me.
Apocalypse Now won the Palme d'Or.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's Bob. It's a great list.
Thank you. And also, yeah. Now of the ones that I mentioned, like Ten Commandments, Gone with the Wind, Jurassic Park, All the President's Men, Rosemary's Baby, Oz, Gone Girl, Cuckoo's Nest, Matilda, Carrie, Arrival. Would you have parked any of those in there? Maybe Arrival?
Maybe Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
Like, to me, Arrival's a better movie, but what Jurassic Park did and what they did to that book, and it just changed the way we watch cinema. So I think I would probably go with...
It's like a pulpy, smart book,
mm-hmm.
and it's kind of a pulpy, smart movie.
Yeah.
Like, the genius of Spielberg is, you know, he can do the prestige stuff really well, but I actually think he does the pulp stuff better. Like, Close Encounters of the Third Kind is science fiction. It's pulp. You know what I mean? It just looks so good. But he's not doing like a high fancy falutin thing. It's kind of just like Aliens and how weird it is to run into aliens. It has a real 1950s feel to it.
Yeah.
You know, Jaws is pulp. Indiana Jones is pulp. It's the old movies from the 1920s and 30s. What do they call those? Cliffhangers? What do they call those reels?
Talkies or not? No.
I forget
as well.
But anyway, like, Spielberg has the ability to take the things that we love that are fun and entertaining and turn them into fun and entertaining movies.
And that's what I wanted from the Blue Jays. I just wanted something in the end fun and entertaining. And I'll end with this. And Bob, great job by you. Carried this whole episode.
You've been in shock.
Yeah.
If people are listening to thinking, poor Bob, like, or Bob's an asshole, he talked the whole time.
No.
It's because you've been sitting there stunned.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's just good. I'm glad I just got to cleanse this. But in the end, I now understand Richard Dreyfuss, where at the end of Close Encounters, he's like, there's the real world. Oh, fuck it. I'm going to get in this spaceship. Hopefully it's better up there.
Thanks for listening to the Macko and Cause podcast. Remember to subscribe on iTunes or Audioboom. And if you like the podcast, leave a review. If you don't like the podcast, then maybe don't leave a review.